Woody Shaw and a band of great sidemen with Dat Deer. That's the name of the tune, Dat Deer, which is a counterfoil to This Year. Shaw's on trumpet. Steve Turry is on trombone. Kirk Lightsey on piano. Ray Drummond on bass. And Carl Allen on drums. This is from Shaw's 1988 album, Imagination. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. And today you're going to need probably some pen and paper, because there's a lot of information we're going to share. And it requires us to pay attention even to the minutest details, because it's an extension of reports that we have heard before, but it's getting mighty close. For several years now, the Bill, Hillary, and Chelsea Clinton Foundation has been the principal target of a self-initiated forensic investigation by Charles Ortel, a retired Wall Street banker who, early into his own probe, found evidence that the foundation was a sham, an extremely lucrative money-making operation for the family. The foundation, he found out, not only was operating outside of its original purpose, and that was to build and maintain a presidential library in Little Rock, Arkansas for Bill Clinton, but it also had illegally launched a number of so-called affiliated entities that appeared to be nonprofits, but were in fact additional sources of revenue for the Clintons. And this was managed through an elaborate arrangement that seemed to have escaped the IRS and other investigative bodies for many years. How were they able to accomplish these things without detection or sanction? How were they able to get away with such massive fraud? Ortel has alleged that it is, quote, the largest unprosecuted fraud in history. But how was it able to continue operating all these years with nary an infraction with nothing there against them as an organization. The answer, of course, is cover-ups by governmental officials at the highest levels. Charles Wortel has been reporting his findings on the Clinton Foundation for more than 2 years now. And we are very grateful for the intensity of his work and the level at which he is going about his investigation. His reports, in fact, have kick-started probes by several governments around the world who had contributed billions of dollars to the foundation's purported good works. But here in the United States, cover-ups provided unprecedented protection for the Clintons and their so-called foundation. On Lead Stories today, Charles Wortel asserts that the evidence shows the Clinton cover-up road leads directly to former President Barack H. Obama. And that's where we're going today, making further links and getting closer to something of an answer as to how this massive fraud continued for so many years without any problem. Thanks, Charles, for being with us.
It is my great pleasure.
Well, I've already warned listeners that this requires really close listening. And, you know, you may need a piece of paper and a pen to just draw the diagrams of who is linked to whom. But could you give us an overview of this premise, of this this finding that it goes, the cover-ups that we've been talking about, and the last cover-up we talked about stopped at Comey, John, and we are now going beyond Comey into the realm of Mr. Obama. First, could you give us this leap?
Sure.
Tell us how it came to be, how you established this link.
Sure. So, you know, where I think you need to go, and I got into this by accident, having exposed what I continue to be believe is an even larger fraud, that being General Electric Corporation, whose stock, I might add, is down almost 5% today in the market, where the market is off only, last I checked a few minutes ago, down 0.2%. The key to going through and seeing the obvious, and these are obvious frauds in both cases, is to understand when the human mind sees a tragedy, there's the willing suspension of natural disbelief. You know, that's one of the key, you know, sort of, I think, human factors or factors in humanity that causes us to miss the obvious. You know, we willingly suspend our propensity to be cynical and to ask the kind of tough questions. And that's how frauds this large can flourish in plain sight for so long. So when you think about the Clinton Foundation, and the reason to say I got excited about it is the wrong word, but when I realized that it was worthwhile taking the kind of effort that I have taken and will take until this is fully exposed and fully documented and fully prosecuted and people are fully held accountable, was when I realized that in the land of foundations and public charities, actually the rules that were set up long ago are pretty good and can lead you into a place where you trap yourself. And that's exactly what the Clintons have done here. With this foundation, the biggest mistake they ever made, and they could have pulled this off had they not done the foundation, was to create a charity. Had they instead created a private company, just call it a business development or professional consulting firm or something like that, and handle it that way, they would have never gotten caught. But by creating a public charity, you suddenly run into a thicket of rules, state level rules. In certain cases, cities have rules. Certainly, the federal government of the United States has rules. And around the world, many different governments regulate charities in many different ways and force you to make disclosures under penalties of perjury or their equivalent around the world. And that's exactly what the Clintons have done since October 23, 1997. I liken it to, I don't know how many of our listeners play the game, the card game of hearts. But in the case of the simple way to think about that card game, you can play it with, you know, three or four hands, partners rather, three or four people can play, is that you don't want to end up with hearts at the in each, you know, at the end of the game. There are hearts or negative points. Unless you could get all the hearts, all 13 hearts, and the queen of spades, in which case that's called shooting the moon. And there you get gigantic extra points. So when you make a decision to shoot the moon, you better be sure you've counted all your cards. Because if you don't get there, you really blow, you just shoot yourself in the head. And that's, I think, what the Clintons did. They regarded the game of life as a game of hearts. And actually, I won't use the word, but one of Bill Clinton's favorite games is, let's just say it's called Aw Shucks, although it sort of rhymes with that word, but it's not shucks. and it's a similar kind of game, only there the negative cards, I believe, are spades. So you go back into Bill Clinton's history, and I learned from the eminent investigative reporter Lee Stranahan, who I had on my own podcast show a number of days ago, I didn't appreciate that Bill Clinton, when he was at Georgetown, studied under a person, professor, whose one of his particular specialties was charity fraud. So exposing the large charity frauds that happen in England. So it's possible that Bill Clinton has long known about the idea that charities are a perfect cover for fraud. And sadly, you know, there are so many excellent charities, but just a few of them can tarnish the whole sector. And I think what Clinton and the people around them realized is that nobody on an international charity, nobody is ever going to be able to establish what you really did with the money. You know, unless a donor gets on a plane and puts people on the ground before he or she gets to the country to make sure that you're not watching a show as opposed to, you know, what was really happening, you're never going to really understand what was happening in remote Haiti. Or, you know, you know, in remote Africa, deepest, you know, the most difficult to access parts of Africa, which are many of them, you're never really going to know. And so, and a lot of times, some of the people who give away big money, I call it conscience money. These are people who, you know, may have bent the rules, let's just say, in the past, and they feel guilty about it as they age. So they say, hey, what the hell? You know, we'll put some money into a charity and, you know, maybe it'll go to good works and feel a little bit guilty about it, so some of it spills out. You know, it's not a big deal. So once you appreciate as a fraudster, which I am, and I will say on this podcast, I think Bill Clinton is a fraudster. I mean, if you cared about your reputation, you would never do the kind of things that Bill Clinton has done with his wife and daughter. You would never allow your name to be dragged into this sort of activity. So on the other hand, if you're a fraudster and you believe that a charity is a very useful way, you start thinking about the different ways in which an international charity can engage in activity. Just 1 second, Dietrich, I got to say one thing to somebody here.
Yeah.
Oh, well, whatever. You look at a charity whose trustees are your political cronies. I mean, the original trustees of this charity were David Pryor, who was a longstanding sort of godfather of Arkansas Democratic politics, a former senator and governor and chairman of the Arkansas Democratic Party. His son, Mark, from 99 till 2003, was the attorney general of Arkansas, who could make sure that no inquiry went into this charity. You had an acolyte of both Clinton and Pryor. Skip Rutherford was the president. And Vernon Jordan's wife, you know, was the third trustee. So you had three Democratic partisans and acolytes of the Clintons as trustees. You had, obviously, an accounting firm BKD, Boy King Dog, a firm that in quotes audited this thing, but in practice committed professional fraud in my view, from October 23, 1997 until they did their final report for 2012. You know, that's a long period of time to issue all kinds of fraudulent statements that were circulated around the world. And clearly BKD made a calculated decision and said, you know, we're going to look the other way here and hope that business spills back our way to more than cover off whatever negative pain we may have suffered. So you put together something that by design is leaky, and you have the enormous celebrity power of Bill Clinton and then his wife, the power couple, you know, going from the White House and then Hillary to the Senate and then being the presumptive nominee and by 2007 and 8 only to lose to Barack Obama and then waiting in the wings to run again, the presumptive winner in 2016. You put their star power together with the need for crooked donors around the world to route sums towards politically powerful people inside and outside the United States through a vehicle like this thing. And, it, you know, in quotes, it's a perfect vehicle for fraud. You know, who's going to question in Africa what the Clintons really did with the money? You know, they're raising money from international donors through their foundation, beside their foundation, around their foundation. That is going into places, some of which are, you know, as corrupt as the United States and Arkansas. And the leaders of those countries are very happy to, you know, have a link to an incoming tidal wave of billions of dollars. And in addition, you know, if you've got these strict rules about routing money inside the United States or exiting the United States that apply to individuals and corporations, but the system for policing charities is very lax. So you can send money to a charity, let's say a fictitious branch of the Clinton Foundation somewhere, to a country run by an ally. You claim the deduction in the U.S., or the U.K., or Canada, and then you get on your private jet and you go to the branch, the window in the local bank, and you cash the check. And you walk out with the cash and split it with the, you know, with the foundation or the people around the foundation or whatever. It is a perfect vehicle for fraud. And I think what happened here, these fraudsters are very clever. I mean, people make the mistake of assuming that a fraudster is an idiot for breaking the law. It's the reverse. Fraudsters, you know, think they are smarter than the regulators and the policemen. And, you know, look at this fraud. It's been going on since October 23rd, 1997. How many prizes has Bill Clinton gotten for his good works? How much public positive perception has been gleaned by the family for their supposed good works? What benefits have they derived over time? They were dead broke, according to their own admission in 1998, 1999. Today, they're worth over $100 million. How has this fraud hurt them? It's helped them. And so, you know, what they do, what fraudsters do, is they try to involve as many people as possible in the fraud, giving them then an option of looking stupid or just, you know, slinking away and hoping they don't ever actually get tagged criminally. So I think what happened here is that the Clintons were very clever to involve members, let's say people close to the Bush family. We know that started by the Katrina period or the tsunami period, which is a bit earlier, late December 2004, early January 2005, when HW became involved with Bill Clinton, in theory, raising money for the tsunami. Cynics go further back and point out that there may have been some involvement back when Bill Clinton was governor, all the way back between HW and Bill Clinton over the refugee problem. There had been a problem in Arkansas and then in the Maine problem, you know, where in theory people argue that planes filled with drugs landed at Maine Airport while Bill Clinton was governor, and he had to have known about that. So, you know, this could be something that goes way, way back, that involves Republicans and Democrats. It involves conservatives and progressives. And, you know, when we think through a political lens, it's very difficult. I mean, to go to somebody, particularly now in 2016, you know, or 2016 is a good period, or 2007, 8, to go to somebody and say, when the economy is turmoiling, what you should do is part with a $100,000 check that you can't gain a tax deduction for. So you have to pay taxes on that money and give it to my political action committee. You get no tax benefit. You know, it's extremely difficult to make the argument that you should do that for the love of your country. But it's a lot easier to make that argument if you say, hey, put $100,000 into my foundation, get a tax deduction, and I'll make you ambassador to you, what country do you want? You know? So this is something that's been going on for a long time. Powerful people in both parties do not want this to be exposed. I think what we're seeing here, and we can say what we want, and I know you have your views on Trump, we can say what we want about Donald Trump, but he clearly is disrupting the existing system, the status quo, maybe trying in theory possibly to drain the swamp. There was no way this was going to get exposed under a Jeb Bush presidency, certainly not under a Hillary Clinton presidency. And then you have to go back and ask yourself, you know, why couldn't people find this when the Clinton Foundation was under investigation? I was doing work this morning. You know, I always, all I do is work. But I was going back and trying to connect the dots on Hillary's campaign for Senate. So I went back and looked at the facts, looked at the Clinton Foundation filings, and I discovered that Hillary Clinton announced her candidacy or the thought that she might run for Senate 4 days after Bill was acquitted in the Senate on February 16th, 1999. By July 7th, when she had did the photo op at Daniel Patrick Moynihan's farm in upstate New York, announcing an exploratory committee, the Clinton Foundation had been in existence from October 23rd, 1997 until that date. So almost, let's call it 1¾ years. Wouldn't you know that in that period, the Clinton Foundation declared, despite having, you know, been actively fundraising, that they had received only 4 contributions. That's it. 4. Now, though they'd registered in numerous states to do, you know, wide direct mail campaigns, they claimed 4 contributions. No way. There is no way that's all they got. And, you know, so you have a foundation, you can solicit. If no one's really going to check the books carefully, you could give the donor a tax deduction, robbing the treasury of money, and you could then divert the money to either directly fund a campaign or indirectly fund it by, you know, for your travel portion of expenses. If you, let's say you've got legal bills or travel bills or other bills, you know, personal bills, personnel bills, that is, that the campaign might have to bear, instead of having the campaign for it, pay for it, you have your foundation pay for it. And so there were no controls on this. This was under Bill Clinton's watch when he was president. He had been, as I said, he'd escaped conviction in the Senate on the 12th of February, 1999. So he had his remainder time there where he was president. His person ran the Department of Justice. His person ran the IRS. His person ran the FTC. He was very sure he would never get caught for anything else. And, you know, that's, and they also hoped that an ally might succeed them. So they were off to the races. And then the unthinkable happened. George W. Bush got elected. So they had a narrow window to make sure that they seeded, you know, their people into the, you know, into the career positions that might push the levers on prosecution. They put Lois Lerner from the Federal Election Commission into the IRS over the foundation regulatory piece. And, they probably had many other people who were, you know, nominally career appointees, but actually partisans. And they fought like crazy against George W. and were able, to make sure that, though there was a furor in 2001 when he pardoned, when Bill Clinton pardoned on the 20th of January, Mark Rich and Pincus Green, who were two unconvicted criminals who had fled the country, having cheated the Treasury out of hundreds of millions of U.S. dollars. When he pardoned those people in the dead of night on the 20th of January, furor erupted. There were, you know, the file is out there. We've talked about it, the FBI vault file. It's the two dumps. You just Google William J. Clinton Foundation. You'll see for yourself what I'm talking about. A lot of activity in 2001. And then, you know, even though it was obvious, everything I just talked about and more is obviously in the public record, the team could not convict, though there were open grand juries. They couldn't convict. They couldn't bring an indictment in 2001. And then guess who gets put in to replace Mary Jo White, leading the effort to actually prosecute the Clinton Foundation? None other than James Comey. Guess who was head of the FBI from September 4th, 2001 to September 4th, 2013? None other than Robert Mueller. Yes, who was in the Justice Department from 2001 to 2005, overseeing the tax division, deciding which tax frauds got prosecuted. None other than Rod Rosenstein. So you see, there are just too many coincidences like that, and the public record is too scarred, too defective, too obviously a fraud for there to be any other explanation that there are people in both political parties, Republicans and Democrats, establishment figures, who were very happy to let this thing move along and then potentially to emulate it. You know, how many other foundations are there like the Clinton Foundation that are involved dynastic political families that want to basically use this foundation as a vehicle to gather assets, gather funding, gather resources to pay for these very expensive political campaigns other than using after-tax dollars? How many of them are there? And so when I saw this way back when, and when I realized that, you know, this, when I realized just how big and how vital and how distinctive the public sector is, you know, that not-for-profit sector. And when I, you know, I have myself, and I know you, Therese, you have, and I'm sure our listeners have, are aware of the many people who, you know, may or may not have a lot of money themselves, but money isn't precious and time is. And you know, I thought of the many people who devote their time, who could do other things, to really thinking about how to help others. And many times these people are not themselves financially well off. Many times these are the same people who could need help, but they're too proud or too grateful for their own lives. And they say, you know what? As bad as my own situation is, I'm going to find somebody in worse shape and I'm going to help that person out. And I don't want anything for it. I don't want recognition. I don't want a title. I don't want a newspaper article about me. I do want to do this in the quiet of the night or day. And there are really literally millions of these people who do things like that. And when I saw what the Clintons were doing, we've talked about it. I've described it as Robin Hood in reverse. What they're doing is stealing from the poor to give to the rich to make themselves rich. When I saw that, I realized, you know, this is a tale that needs to get told, not in partisan terms, because they're very good. I'm not a political expert, and they are. They're very good at saying that anybody who criticizes them is obviously a political enemy. This isn't a partisan issue. This is an issue that can and should and may well unite the country and the world, that charities may not be used for personal enrichment. They may not be used for political advancement, and that is crystal clear. We don't need to debate the meaning of the word is. We don't need to get into convoluted arguments. It is just simply dead wrong, flat wrong, to go around the world taking credit for a charity that you don't control properly, where donors are using the charity to exact political favors and even concoct business deals around the world. You shouldn't be going around the world taking credit for that. And when you do, and when you're caught on the scale that we're talking about here, over $100 billion likely, you know, if you're going to put Corinne Brown in prison for 5 years for $800,000, you're going to put Steve Stockman, a Republican, conservative Republican, facing prison time for 23 felony counts over $1.3 million, you've got to put a lot of people in prison here. And it's got to be not simply members of the Clinton family and their trustees. It's got to be professional firms. It may have to be regulators who did not do their job or who obstructed justice. It may be people like Lois Lerner. And then with all that said, and it's a long answer to your short question, there is no way to explain how Barack Obama and the incoming Obama administration let this thing not only happen, but flourish and escalate under his presidency. Don't tell
me. All right.
Me
so let's tackle that part of the puzzle today.
Okay.
I would like you to put some context to it, going a bit beyond Obama to figures that we have discussed before, like Comey, and the kinds of protection that these individuals who were strategically placed in the administration, both the Clinton administration and then eventually in the Obama administration, how did they afford a level of protection that seemed impervious to any inquiry?
Well, so here's what I think may well have happened here, particularly in this day and age of metadata and advancing technology and prolific use by most of us of cell phones and computers and things like that. You go back into history decades ago, when technology tools were not as strong, J. Edgar Hoover developed files, it's alleged, on virtually anybody of significance and was able to have tremendous leverage over many, many people for decades. Imagine what a crooked head of the FBI could do, you know, in this day and age. Just imagine what such a person might be able to do. And so we have to remember in Comey that he succeeded Mueller on the 4th of September, 2013. Now, that's just exactly when the Clinton Foundation, within several, 2 months roughly, the Clinton Foundation entered a new and low chapter in the below the sub-basement of life when the Clinton family on the 2nd of November, 2013, the Clinton family illegally changed the bylaws of the parent Clinton Foundation to install themselves in a position of power over the Clinton Foundation board meetings, and more importantly, in between board meetings for their lives, giving the outside directors no ability to review any aspect of the Clinton Foundation. That is boldly against the law, so of course they tried to hide it. But unfortunately, they did not succeed in hiding it, and the truth of that is found on the New York State Charity Bureau website, where you can see a second version, not the first version, but a second version of the amendment that occurred on the 10th of September, 2015, when Hillary Clinton's name was taken off as one of those three controlling directors, the other two being Bill and Chelsea. Okay, so here's, you know, Jim Comey, he had personally led the first investigation of the Clinton Foundation. Now, maybe he has an IQ of 3, which I don't think is the case. So let's assume he's smart. You know, take the other side of the argument. If a person like Jim Comey had not only he led the first Clinton Foundation investigation that was unsuccessful, he then had Rod Rosenstein's position running the entire Justice Department until sometime, I think in August or thereabouts, 2005. He comes back into a junior position from that. The head of the FBI reports to the Deputy Attorney General. So he's now taking a demotion to be head of FBI. Why would he do that? Why would he leave a lucrative career where he amassed a ton of money to go back and for a demotion under Obama? And in this time frame, the Clinton Foundation went from, you know, medium fraud to global mega fraud. They you know, had brought in a new CEO, and Eric Braverman, by July of 2013. He suddenly leaves on January 9th, 2015. All the while, here's, you know, James Comey's head of the FBI with his history, having, you know, actually been in charge of, you know, this noteworthy investigation. How could he not have known about all these problems at the Clinton Foundation and then, you know, let them go, you know? And then, you know, going into this period, I just preparing for this broadcast, I went back and I looked at, refreshed my recollection of when I first was on your show, and it was May 23rd, 2016. And you had me on, thank you for that, and thanks for having me on today. Actually, and sorry to your listeners for this, but you had me on, I think, like 4 or 5 days in a row. And then you had me back on. And then in July, Richard Pollack, first Marsha Blackburn sent a letter that instigated an investigation, a publicly acknowledged investigation in the IRS, which by July 27th, Richard Pollack wrote a story saying that there were 4 field offices were actively involved. That caused a furor. That story got wide publicity. And so then with that, we hear, you know, we're now learning and confirming that August 12th, 2016, someone directed the FBI to stop doing this work. We know from Cheryl Atkinson's fantastic book, The Smear, that the New York Times knew about this. And rather than publicize it, which would have had, I mean, had the New York Times acknowledged what it did apparently know, that there were indeed 4 different field office investigations into fraud at the Clinton Foundation, in July of 2016, August 2016, the Democrats would have had a chance to tell Hillary Clinton, oh, no, you don't, and put in a candidate who might have beaten Trump. And so, you know, and it's impossible that Comey and his team did not know about this. It's impossible. And therefore, up the chain, it's also impossible, in my view, given the importance of this. Remember, we talked about hearts, the card game of hearts. You know, you're down a road in here where there's a lot of pain once the truth comes out for a lot of people. And the only solution, your salvation, if you're part of this team, the crooked team that has been allowing this Clinton Foundation mess to flourish, is to have a president in your pocket in January 20th, 2017 forward. So, you know, a lot of people made a lot of mistakes here. There was never a real investigation into the Clinton Foundation. That's what we're going to find out about now, I hope, assuming, you know, they haven't gotten to Horowitz. In the Horowitz report, Inspector General Horowitz's report, we're going to find out at the very minimum what he did, how thorough he was, and if he was, you know, even a little bit thorough, then the truth is going to come out here, and we're going to know who knew. And, you know, it could well be that we're past a point where vulnerable people already have seen the obvious and have seen that, you know, you can no longer hope. When you smell that smell around the Christmas tree, you realize, you know, you can hope for a pony, but in reality, you know what's down there next to the Christmas tree. There's no point in hoping for a pony right now. This is going to go, I think, you know, barring unforeseen circumstances, this is going to go right out of the public domain. All the people who were been suspending their disbelief willingly are going to suddenly pull a switch and a lever and say, now, wait a minute, why was I this stupid? And I can tell you that process is going on in multiple governments right now around the world.
I still want to get a little bit more detail about the role you think, based on your examination of the facts and figures, the role of James Comey, which is very, very vital, and how Barack Obama became embroiled in this business of protecting Hillary Clinton.
Okay, so I think to answer your question, Teresa, and I promise I will, but to answer your question, it goes back before James Comey. I think the answer to your question starts in 2007-08 timeframe, maybe a little bit earlier before that, when James Comey was in private practice or whatever he was. I think he was at Lockheed at one point, then he was at Bridgewater, then he was outside director for HSBC. One of them, either Mueller or Comey, was. But anyway, I think where this starts is in the decision by the Clintons to run Hillary. She announced, I believe, on January 20th, 2007. And by that time, certainly had a file on Barack Obama. And, you know, who knows what's in that file? I mean, we don't need to go down the rabbit hole of asking all the obvious questions that people ask about Barack Obama's history. But let's just assume the Clintons, who invented the war room, you know, which is a room filled with young, eager volunteers who are prepared to do anything and believe that there are no rules in politics or life, you know, smearing dirt at their opponents in an effort to win. So that group of people certainly had examined as much dirt as possible and had, you have to presume, dirt on Barack Obama. They tried to play it various ways during the primary season. They tried to intimidate, as they usually do, all comers in the primary season or thinking about announcing. They had a gigantic war chest. They had the Clinton Foundation. They had access to all kinds of money. And Hillary was, in 2008, there's no other way to say it, she was a horrible candidate and a complete upstart. Barack Obama, with a thin political resume at national level, did the impossible. He bested Hillary Clinton. So I think the key to this, understanding the answer to your question, starts in Dianne Feinstein's house on a June afternoon or evening. I forget the exact day, but it's in the public domain. Hillary, you know, was not inclined to give up, but at a meeting in Dianne Feinstein's house, there was Barack and Hillary got together, and had a hash, you know, thrashed it out. And, you know, maybe before then the points of understanding were agreed, but by then and after then, some sort of detente was reached. And as a guest, you know, the Clinton message was, listen, you know, we will support you because we want a Democrat in the White House, and you're going to have a historic presidency, but we are going to call a lot of shots, and don't you even dream about touching our Clinton Foundation. Just don't even dream about it. That ain't happening. And then you look at, you know, again, I'm not a political expert, a practicing political expert, but I do follow what's happened in politics, and I've been around, you know, got decades to prove it. And, you know, I think I sort of understand the human psyche a little bit. Here's a person who on paper, I mean, you got to give Barack Obama and his people credit for beating the Clinton machine and then thrashing McCain. It wasn't close. I mean, it was a thrashing. And starting out January 20th, 2009 with commanding majorities in the House and Senate. I mean, that's a remarkable achievement for somebody with, I would argue, a very thin political resume. And you think about human nature, you know, you've pulled off the impossible in beating the Clintons. You've pulled it all together. Some might have argued on January 20th why you wanted to inherit the mess that the world and America was in on that day. Nonetheless, you did it all. Why in the heck, and I'll just be, you know, mindful of not cursing, but why in the heck would you allow the former attorney, the deputy attorney general for the Clinton period to be your attorney general, Eric Holder? Why would you allow Hillary Clinton to be your secretary of state? Why would you structure the theory agreement that was going to regulate the relationships between the Clinton Foundation and the Hillary State Department and the federal government? Why would you allow that to be an unenforceable joke of an agreement? You know, why would you do all that? It doesn't make sense unless the Clintons had some sort of a stick over Barack Obama and his people. And, you know, we can guess what that stick might be, but it seems to me that that's sort of the basis for, you know, how this started. And that explains whatever that stick is, the elephant in the room or the donkey in the room, whatever that donkey is, explains why an incoming administration would say, all right, you guys can use alias emails. You can have 100% of the communications that emanate from the Clinton team, Hillary Clinton team on the State Department, running a very important outward-facing, the most important outward-facing cabinet department of long historical significance. We're going to let you use private servers that are not necessarily secure and, you know, in some cases, electronic devices we now know from the investigation that were purchased on eBay, used electronic devices that are not secure. We'll let you do that for your entire four-year period, and nobody's going to complain about it. There won't be an inspector general in the State Department. You know, this stuff doesn't happen by accident. So the explanation for it all is there must be something negative in the background of the president, former president, and or of people around the former president that allowed the Clintons to gain this kind of leverage. So then you have to make sure that you control the investigative process. So you do it. You've got Bob Mueller in there. Why he stayed in there for so long? Remember that his 10-year term was up. Let's see, it wasn't 10 years, was it? September 4th. Yeah, his 10-year term was up in 2011. You know, why did he stay on for a partial year through the 2012 election? You know, how did that calculation arise? What sort of information might we be able to find out about that? What sort of knowledge did he have about all this mess, having been head of the FBI with his team in place for that long? What did he know about all this? And then why did he select Comey? You know, why did he pick Comey, and how much diligence did Comey do? We know now from recent history that Comey is a proven liar and a proven leaker. Why would you select somebody like that to be your replacement? And I don't think, you know, honestly, looking at across the whole spectrum here, no disrespect meant to you, Eutrice, but journalists in the main, in my experience now, sort of working with them on and off for 10 years or so, journalists tend to be very good with words and hopeless with numbers. And to see the magnitude of this Clinton Foundation corruption, to see the magnitude of, you know, corruption in general, you've got to be very good with numbers. So I think our mainstream press has not done the work that needed to be done that allowed for this to happen for so long. Let's hope now, you know, with all the good work you've been doing, Yatrice, and others have been doing, and that, you know, that we're now in a moment where the public is, you know, we're not taking it anymore. We want to know actually what happened, not the book, actually what happened. And it sure smells and reeks as if James Comey was put into the FBI the same way he was put in the Southern District of New York to cover up the corruption, not to expose it. And he was a willing
Speaking of which, let's remind the audience that we have some interesting aspects to this fraud. It is not only domestic, it is international in scope. And we have had several administrations that should have looked at it and found something wrong here that they never did. And we're talking now just about the sheer amount of money, which would make you shake in your boots when you realize how they were able to pull this off and still not be made accountable for hundreds of billions of dollars.
I used to think, you know, when Maxine Waters would say, you know, that the American government is distributing drugs that are meant to kill people of color or people around the world, I used to think that she is really completely off her rocker. But I'm sorry to say that when you look at the Clinton Foundation case, you know, there's a sad set of truths here, that is exactly what I think did happen. And, you know, it's one thing to say that, you know, what we want to do as Americans is, you know, we're a wealthy country, we want to really, truly try to help people around the world. You know, there's an argument that, you know, perhaps we should help the poor people in the inner cities of America first before we spend a lot of time. You know, we're not so good at helping them before we traipse around the world. But, you know, let's say that we've got enough generosity in our hearts to argue that we can try to do both. Well, if you're going to do both, you better damn well make sure that you're doing it properly and that you're not, in fact, harming people. And I think this case of distributing the HIV/AIDS drugs around the world is a case that demands a robust examination and explanation. There are a lot of academics. I'm thinking of the Yale professor who's now the president of Vassar, who were deeply involved in this HIV/AIDS exercise with the Clinton Foundation, writing multiple scholarly papers in theory, peer-reviewed scholarly papers, when nobody managed to check, is the Clinton Foundation actually allowed to do any of this work that we're doing with them? Nobody checked that at Yale, at Harvard, at Columbia, at the University of Washington, the Gates Foundation. Nobody checked any of this. You know, I think this could be actually, it's going to be painful for the perpetrators of this fraud, but I think it could be very useful for the process of trying to help people around the world, that we ought to have new standards for that. That, you know, when our hard-earned tax, our hard-earned money, you know, leaves this country in theory to help people around the world, we better have the processes in place to make sure that in fact what it's doing, that it was not doing, is either harming the people in the countries, or, you know, also going back into the hands of either crooked politicians in these poor countries, or crooked politicians here at home, or crooked professional advisors. You know, the policing of aid, as we've talked extensively about in Haiti, the poorest country in the North and South Hemisphere, you know, the Western Hemisphere here, you know, how many billions of dollars went into Haiti that have never been accounted for, that seem to have disappeared, that may well have gone into Clinton crony hands or the Clintons themselves, while the people in Haiti still rot in a country that doesn't have the infrastructure it should have. I mean, the people of Haiti are really owed a lot here. I mean, that's just to pick on one country. There's a place. America began, in theory, the American experiment began on the island of, it's called then Hispaniola, a portion of which, the western portion, is Haiti. You know, so we began on the same moment when, you know, recent period when in theory, when Columbus was the first to reach these shores. Maybe somebody preceded him, but you know, nonetheless, the official history is 1492, that's when we started. And here we are, the biggest country in the world, and there is Haiti, our poor cousin, you know, down in the sewer, even though Bill Clinton supervised $10 to $13 billion going into that country starting after January, whatever date it was, 2010, with the Bush family involved as well. You know, we shouldn't be able to walk away from that. We broke it. We own it, as Colin Powell said famously. And, you know, that happens in too many places in the world. I was on, I have a new friend in a country I won't name, a major donor country to the developing world, who is very much against the idea of looking at these countries as victim countries, but instead saying, you know, these are countries rich in natural resources. How can we help these countries to develop actual businesses so that they're not always on life support looking for aid? And he told me that that indeed is the thinking now of these. This isn't 1977 when I first went to Africa. You know, we've been experimenting with this for 41 years or longer. There's a new generation of people. They're highly educated. They don't see why, you know, if it's possible to start, you know, something in an attic, Wisconsin or somewhere, or Dublin, why isn't it possible to start something using the internet and elsewhere? There are plenty of smart people in Africa and in Asia and elsewhere. Why can't you do the same thing there? And so this whole idea of using aid as a way to sell American products that you can't sell here, or allowing people to dump stuff that no America would ever use over in these countries, or dump adulterated drugs. I mean, we got to go back over this ground and make sure that the people who've been doing this sort of people, like the Clintons, taking credit for being modern philanthrocapitalists, as they call themselves, you know, are fully exposed, punished, and the rules of the game changed. The incentives changed. So these starry-eyed young people who come out of the elite universities and think that they're going to change the world understand that when they get into a country like Haiti or some of these other countries where the Clintons have, I think, behaved badly, that, you know, they're not going there to go on an expensive vacation and live lifestyles they couldn't afford in the United States. They're going there to truly help. And if the crooked, if they discover criminality in these foundations, there should be an incentive for these starry-eyed people to report on their bosses, and the IRS should be fundamentally changed when it comes to regulating charities. There's now the one part of the tax code I did confirm that is the new game in town for people is that there is an unlimited ability to make deductions for charities. So state and local taxes are limited, but unlimited for charities, which means there's going to be big incentives to commit charity fraud, particularly on these international charities that are not regulated. So, you know, I think this whole area of allowing a charity, the Clinton Foundation, for example, has never had the authority to act internationally. How could you miss that as James Comey? You know, it's plainly stated in the IRS application that it will not be an international. All of its activities will occur in Little Rock, Arkansas, which last I checked is inside the United States of America. How can you miss that, as James Comey?
Well, you just have to have the right incentives. And apparently he was given the right incentives to miss these things. We're coming close to the end of the program, Charles. Let's talk about this is a very important opening here because we had kind of surmised it, but now there is more and more a concrete link, and even so, not enough information to solidify it. And that is, what role specifically did Barack Obama play in covering up the largest unprosecuted charity fraud in history?
Well, you know, Barack Obama, I've never met him. I probably never will meet him, but he's certainly a smart individual. And he started out with nothing and is now living like, you know, the King of Siam in multiple mansions and private jets and fancy vacations and this and that. When he was president, he devoted the biggest portion of his Nobel Peace Prize winnings the Clinton-Bush Haiti Fund, donating it more than $200,000, and that thing was not properly organized or operated, and therefore that deduction that he took for $200,000+ should be disallowed. So he, you know, maybe he didn't care then about $200,000, which was roughly 40% of his salary as president, but I suspect he did. Did he do enough due diligence on that thing? No, he didn't. Did he send his money before Lois Lerner granted federal tax exemption for that entity? Yes, he did. Did he have tax exposure? Yes, he did. So, you know, on a personal level, you know, he may have been trapped, but it may have started even before then. Perhaps the Clintons, you know, whatever that leverage is, that donkey in the room, June 2008, whatever donkey was played then, was hanging over his head. He allowed, I mean, his team, it may not have been him personally, but his team, actually, as I think about it, you remember, he wanted to use a BlackBerry. He was the first president who would ever use a BlackBerry. And the initial answer came back, oh, no, you don't. But he managed to get a BlackBerry. And so Hillary wanted one, and she was told, oh, no, you can't do it, only the president. So, I mean, here's a president. He's the first president who ever sent a tweet. Tech savvy. He was addicted to his BlackBerry, supposedly. You know, a person like that, and I know I'm not tech savvy, but I do not open an email from some address I don't know. So, you know, how in the heck is the president of the United States, incoming president of the United States, going to be sending emails on an alias and receiving emails on an alias from a non-government and therefore not possibly non-secure account? How do you do that? Why do you do that? How did you not notice that happening in the very beginning of your presidency?
A lot of things they don't notice. Well, we've come to the end of the program today. I just want to remind listeners that you can follow up on some of these topics with Charles on Sunday. That's the name of Sunday with Charles, sorry, the name of his program and podcast, airing at 1:00. Thanks so much for being with us today, as always, and we will follow up. We continue to follow this story. Thanks so much, Charles.
Thank you, Adrian.